If you happen to be reading the abstract for my talk, you'll see there are three parts. And there are three parts because when I was forced to write the abstract, I didn't have a clue what I was going to talk about. So, you know, I just wrote three things and figured with high probability I could talk about one of them by the time the conference occurred. So consequently, I'm going to talk primarily about A in the abstract, but I realize with 40 minutes, if the first part goes well, I would sorely like to tell you a little bit about this conditional value at risk approach to portfolios, which Terry Rockefeller and Yuri Osef blew open a couple years ago. But I have another antidote before I get started, because I've been kind of mucking around and trying to apply robustness to finance, which is that, first of all, if you want to read a really good book on the background of financial econometrics, I recommend the book by Campbell, Lowe, and McKinley. It's called The Econometrics of Financial Markets. It's at Princeton University Press, very inexpensive, $49 or $59. Is it getting thicker? It's still first edition. No. But so the thing, interesting thing about this book, it's the first book on financial econometrics that I've seen where there are actually some modern statistical methods in the book. Now, if you look at the practice of academic finance research, aside from the new programs in financial engineering and mathematical finance, they have a fairly narrow focus, I would say, even on record with the camera. And when I met Andrew Lowe, who's started the financial engineering program at MIT, and he's now running a hedge fund in Cambridge, I complimented him on the fact that in the book, he has a section on nonparametric regression, a section on neural networks, and so on. And without missing a beat, he said to me, "Yes, I call it intellectual arbitrage." So I assume you all know what arbitrage means. So what I'm engaged in here is intellectual arbitrage. I want to start by reviewing very briefly the mathematics and basic theory of mean variance optimal portfolios, assuming that, although I know some of you know something about this, most people in statistics don't know anything about it. And I'm going to concentrate mainly on the second bullet point, which is calculating some influence functions. And this is fairly routine stuff, except that they're more messy, much more messy expressions, and a few little surprises started popping out, to the extent that, while this is just the beginning, I mean, I literally did these computations this week, that I'm kind of intrigued by where it may lead, and then I'll stop with some open questions. First of all, I want to make sure that the terminology is familiar to everyone. So think about stock returns. It could be other assets, but one-period returns are just the relative change in price from one period to the next. Portfolio returns are just, you have portfolio weights, and you just portion your wealth up among the various stocks, say, N of them that you like to invest in, and write this in inner product form as a weight vector times a return vector. R is the random variable. A fully invested portfolio is one for which the weights sum to 1. So that would be 1 transpose, W is 1. And my 1 here, when you see it, most of the time, it'll be a vector of ones. A zero investment portfolio is one in which the weights sum to 0. What that means is some of the weights are negative and some are positive. It means you take short positions in some assets and you take long positions in other assets. If short selling is allowed, the weights in optimal solutions are unbounded. They can be arbitrarily large and positive or arbitrarily small and negative. And I want to return this to this only at the end of the talk. The no short selling constraint means all the weights have to be positive. And it's very often true that portfolio managers are prohibited by their sponsors from doing short selling. Or if they're allowed to do short selling, they have some sort of, you know, bound that's not too negative on the short selling. So here's the picture worth 1,000 words. The name of the game is that you're a portfolio manager and you look in mean standard deviation space, where this is the mean of your portfolio returns, expected value portfolio returns. This is standard deviation, usually taken to be risk. And what you want to do is, subject that you specify you want to get returns at least to some value on the vertical axis, then you minimize the standard deviation, subject to the constraint that the weights sum to 1 so that you're fully invested. So you really end up, it turns out that this is a quadratic form, and you're minimizing the quadratic form to come over here, subject to 2 equality constraints, namely that you achieve a certain return here and that the weights sum to 1. And the solution to that problem is a straightforward calculus of variations with Lagrange multipliers, and if you solve it, as every PhD student in finance does, goes through in a course, you get this black curve, which is called the efficient frontier. There is an interesting, unique point called the, what I call MV. It's the global minimum variance portfolio. If you drop the constraint that you achieve a specific return, solve the problem, you get a solution, which is this portfolio here, characterized by a set of weights and a standard deviation here and a mean return there. And if you have a risk-free rate, generally that's a short-term T-bill, a 90-day T-bill, then what happens is you get a straight line here which intersects with the efficient frontier at a point called the tangency portfolio under idealized assumptions. It's a market portfolio. And then if you your most advantageous situation is to operate along this line where you mix some amount of the risk-free rate with some amount of this portfolio. And where you work along this line depends on your risk preferences. And the ideal approach, you have a utility function, and then you can find out where you are with the with respect to the utility function. So this is just a second-order theory kind of problem. You have a p by 1 mean vector for p assets, p stocks, and a covariance matrix. And assuming you know those, you can crank out this very messy-looking stuff. Don't stare at it too long. It just this equation here says that the equation for the efficient frontier is a hyperbola, and all of the constants in here are determined by just knowing the covariance matrix and the mean vector. These are kind of messy. They'll pop up, you know, a quadratic form here and quadratic form here and sort of a linear form there. So if you really wanted to draw this curve, the efficient frontier, you could do it if you knew the mean and covariance matrix. And then with a risk-free rate, you can draw this line. But what we're going to focus on now is these two points, the tangency portfolio and the minimum variance portfolio. I'm going to focus on computing influence functions for those quantities and see what properties they have. Now, just so you have in mind, I say a typical mean and covariance matrix. Actually, I took this from the Rockefeller paper because I've been cranking on that example a lot. This was a sample mean and a sample covariance matrix for monthly returns for something like, they didn't say in the paper, but I think they did it for 5 years, 60 observations. So this is the S&P, which on a monthly basis is giving you 1%, so on an annual basis is giving you 12% returns, government bonds lower, small caps higher, covariance matrix here. The square root of the diagonal, which gives you the standard deviations, are here. And I would just ask you to note that if you ask what the precision of a sample mean estimate is for these kinds of typical returns, it is a high fraction of the actual returns. And in fact, this is the source of most of the variability in efficient frontiers and optimal portfolios. So if you imagine how that curve, you know, varied from sample to sample, you just take another sample and estimate mu and see again, it's quite variable. And most of the variability comes from the fact that the mean is not estimated very accurately. For this particular data set, which I'm going to come back to in the end, here's the correlation matrix. I'm not sure what time period it was, but I think it was kind of the hoopy days before the crash, because you've got S&P very highly correlated with the small cap stocks, and a relatively small correlation with government bonds, which is not surprising. So just kind of keep maybe those numbers in mind. So now I'm going to show you some, again, messy-looking expressions. For the global minimum variance portfolio, the weight vector is defined by this ratio, this vector divided by this quadratic form. And once you have that weight vector, you just take the inner product with the mean return vector to get the mean return of the minimum variance portfolio. And then you do the obvious calculation, and it turns out that the variance of the minimum variance portfolio is a very simple expression. So with regard to the global minimum variance portfolio, it doesn't depend on mean returns. It just depends on the covariance matrix. That's the main thing I want to leave you with. Whereas when you go to the tangency portfolio, you get another set of three expressions, and the weight vector up here now, instead of having the vector of ones right here, replaces it with the vector of excess returns. So here's the vector of mean returns for your P stocks, and you subtract off a vector of ones times the risk-free rate. So you express that as the mu e, excess returns, and all of these quantities here, the weight vector and then the mean and variance, rely now on the covariance matrix and the mean vector of returns through the excess returns. Okay? Then there's a quantity called the Sharpe ratio, which is probably, if you want to put your hands on one single number related to optimal portfolios, so it's the Sharpe ratio. The Sharpe ratio is just the return normalized by the risk or standard deviation. So if you look at my next picture here, so if you have an arbitrary portfolio here, you just take, you know, this vertical distance here, which is the excess returns divided by the standard deviation, it's the slope. And the idea is that you can characterize the tangency portfolio as the one that maximizes the Sharpe ratio. You can't get any place else except higher than this blue line. So the tangency portfolio maximizes the Sharpe ratio. And you can go back and plug in things and get an expression for that, okay? So these are the sort of somewhat messy expressions you have to deal with. What I want to say here is now we'll just go to functional representation stuff that everyone here is familiar with. So every quantity in sight, the mean vector, the covariance matrix, the weight vector of the minimum variance portfolio, everything you've seen depends on the contamination distribution. And then I shorten the notation, so I just write gamma in here. So then when you compute derivatives with respect to gamma, the notation's a little simpler. So what we're going to do is compute influence functions based on using in-sample data to compute the weight vector, but act as if we then use this weight vector on future clean data, which is not perturbed by outliers. When I first did these calculations several years ago, I didn't do that, and Victor pointed it out to me. I think this is a more reasonable way to approach things, and we could talk about that later if you want, but it really comes to the heart of a lot of issues about robustness and prediction. You know, how do you evaluate on future data? Is it future data with outliers, or is it future clean data? What I'm doing here is future clean data in sample data that's perturbed. One reason I'm doing that is that I feel comfortable with that is for stocks as opposed to other kinds of assets. Typically, you don't get sort of just a big heavy tail distribution for returns that you can estimate with any degree of reliability. You tend to get, especially with small cap stocks, sort of one or two unusual events. One big positive outlier, maybe two in a four-year period. And then you don't see anything for a long time. And my folk theorem is you can't predict outliers, because if you could, tell me how, because I wouldn't mind having a house in Tahiti myself. So if you do the calculation, start with the weight function for the minimum variance portfolio, which looks like this, now expressed as a function of the fraction contamination. Crank out the derivative, you get a messy-looking expression. And at this point, I just put in here the influence function for the covariance matrix. It could be a classical covariance matrix or a robust covariance matrix at this point. So don't get too much lost in these expressions, except I will tell you that some sort of nice things pop out, surprising things pop out of this somewhat complicated-looking expression. The first property, I first noted it just by direct calculation from that previous expression, that influence function really is a weight vector of a zero investment portfolio. That is, if you take the inner product of the one vector with the influence function, you get zero. There's a typo there. Should be a zero. That's what happens when you work late at night. On the other hand, once I thought of that, it's very clearly true of the influence function for any weight vector of a fully invested or not even a fully invested portfolio, because think about how you compute it. You take the weight vector evaluated at F gamma minus the weight vector at the nominal distribution, divide by gamma, take the limit. If you take the inner product of 1 across the numerator, you get sort of 1 minus 1 for all values of gamma. So this is a general property that the influence function for the weight vector for any portfolio is a zero investment portfolio itself. What I like about this is certain things pop up that are sort of common sort of concepts or are common ways of approaching things in the finance market. Now, I'm not going to do much in this talk with the covariance matrix other than to say that you all know that the classical sample covariance matrix has an influence function that looks like this, where X tilde is just the centered X's. And all I'm going to assume for this talk is that if you have a robust estimate, that for small x it looks like this, and otherwise it's bounded, okay? Because the only things I'm going to talk about are for the small x approximation coming up here. So property two is that You've computed this influence function for the weight vector of the minimum variance portfolio, and it has a messy expression a few slides back. But now I say, well, what happens if you, in fact, put X, the contamination vector, at the mean of the P assets? Then it's true that the influence function is zero. And I say this is an economically appealing result, and it compares with, of course, if you take the influence function for the covariance matrix and set X tilde equal to zero, you get minus C, right? So you don't get zero here, but when you plug it into all this expression that you can easily check, you get zero. And what's economically appealing about that, it says, if you perturb, you put your contamination right at the true mean vector, it has no influence, and that's as it should be, okay? So, and then, okay, so you can compute the influence functions of the return, mean return of the minimum variance portfolio. And this is where what I'm doing is saying, okay, I'm going to evaluate it on future clean returns so that we use an unperturbed mu, so there's no functional dependence of this mu on the contaminating distribution. So you just get something very simple where you just propagate through. So the influence function for this is just mu prime times the influence function for the weight vector.
Future clean returns, or you're cleaning up future returns?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that as a way of evaluating, we're going to act as if we want to know how much effect an outlier in the training sample has when we look at the returns in the future when there are no outliers in the future, right? It has something to do with my earlier comment. If you can predict outliers, let me know, please. This is a topic for more discussion, actually. So, and it turns out that, of course, you can crank out another expression for the influence function of the standard deviation of risk of the minimum variance portfolio. And this one turns out, if you just plug and chug a little bit, oh, never mind, that comes later, sorry. It turns out, this is a property that I would put a question mark. I'm wondering if I did it too late at night. This is very strange. This is very strange. I wouldn't guarantee it absolutely.
I'd be told.
Well, what does it mean if the influence function is identically zero? It means that the estimator must have a faster rate of convergence or something like that, I guess. The only thing I know is that formally, if you plug things in, this happened. And it is true that empirically, people have observed this in the finance literature, that if you look at the variability of your estimate of the risk of the minimum variance portfolio, it's very stable. It doesn't wobble very much. It's only the up and down, the return part that wobbles a lot. So either this is wrong, I blew it, or it's right, and there's something interesting. So somebody figure it out before lunchtime and tell me where I made the mistake. I'm sure somebody here can do it. Okay, now let's move to the tangency portfolio. Okay, you crank it out, and sort of, if I'd been smart, I would have had a graduate student in my class do this cranking, and they probably wouldn't have made any mistakes. Anyway, there's another expression, which now the main thing to note is that because the weight vector for the tangency portfolio depends not only on the covariance matrix, but also on the mean vector through the excess return vector, it's not surprising that the influence function for that weight vector depends not only on the influence function for the covariance matrix, but the influence function for the mean vector, right? That's very natural. They both pop up and weighted in slightly different ways, okay? So, now, the same result is true, again, as for the global minimum variance portfolio. If you make your contamination right at the mean vector, the influence is zero. That's as it should be, and the proof is very, very simple. However, there's another property that I realized, almost by accident, that if you put your contamination mass not at the mean vector, but at a vector of all ones times the risk-free rate, then the influence function is essentially zero for all practical situations that you would encounter. And the reason for that, I sort of sketched it out here, is that if X tilde is small, if you go back to the, I guess you can see it here. I've just substituted in here the influence function for the sample covariance and the sample mean over here, and then I've plugged in for the contamination mass this number here minus mu, and over here the same thing. And if X is small, then this term is essentially zero. The quadratic part, X tilde transpose, is small. So you just cancel that out, and it turns out that everything cancels out. This is an approximation, and then this is identically zero. And I can tell you, I've checked it on many cases with real numbers in there, and it's like 10 to the minus 10, you know, 10 to the minus 16. It's really, essentially zero. And that's economically interesting, too, because it says, well, the risk-free rate is really a special place with regard to investment. And if you put your contamination at the risk-free rate, if there's any economic justice in the world, the influence of that perturbation should be very, very small. So I think this is the kind of thing which is sort of making this like an interesting algebraic exercise, because it has a little bit of... And so you can do the rest of these calculations, like the mean return of the tangency portfolio. And in this one, it turns out if you substitute... let's see, I guess for this one, for calculating the influence function of the risk of the tangency portfolio, it turns out that expression has a very, very nice representation as the influence function for the risk is the influence function for the return divided by the Sharpe ratio. Remember, the Sharpe ratio is for the tangency portfolio is the return of the tangency portfolio over the risk of the tangency portfolio. So this is kind of satisfying to see that, in fact, you know, this relationship holds. The Sharpe ratio is sort of the pivot point there, if you like. You can do the calculations for the Sharpe ratio. I got tired. I got tired last night at midnight. So I want to show you now some calculations in S+. I wrote a little function that will compute all these quantities for the tangency portfolio. So this is this three set of assets, S&P 500 and the government bonds and the small cap portfolio. And I just picked a contaminating vector 0.06, 0.03, 0.06. Remember that the return for the S&P was about 0.01, about 1% a month, about 12% a year. And for the government bonds, I think it was 0.002. And for the small cap stocks, it was close to 0.07, I think. I'm sorry, 0.013, something like that. Anyway, I kind of made these all positive with respect to the mean return values in mu. I put in a risk-free rate of 0.003. And then one of the arguments here is IF relative. Do we return values that are absolute, or do we return them relative to their true values at the tangency portfolio? So the default is true, but I wanted to show you absolute values here. So there's a little program that for this V and mu, the one I showed you at the beginning of the talk, it turned out here's the weight vectors. It turns out that even though they're unconstrained, they all ended up being non-negative, and there was no short selling, and they do add up to 1. Those are the weights put on each of these investments. And then here's the mu, sigma, and Sharpe ratio for the tangency portfolio. And then down here we've got the original contamination vector as output as a row of a matrix, and then the perturbation and the weights. And see, if you look at these absolute weights and check them, you'll see that they sum up to 1. Remember, the property of the weights is that they represent a zero investment portfolio. And then here's the absolute changes in mu, sigma, and the Sharpe ratio. And now I did the same thing, but I do things on a relative basis. And furthermore, I put gamma equal 0.01 to say, now we want an approximation for how much did these quantities change relatively if I had, you know, I added 1 point in 100. So I have 1 contamination point out of 100, which is, you know, if you have 2 years of weekly data, that's 104 points. Kind of a typical...
Can I ask a quick question? Yeah. What is the gamma added to? What is the contamination added to when you differentiate?
Well, the bias approximation is the weight vector under the contamination minus the weight vector with no contamination is approximately equal to gamma times the influence function. So if you want to get a handle on how much it's actually perturbing in a realistic situation, this is what you would do. So in this case down here, now the weights don't cancel or anything because I've made everything relative, but this is in standard deviation units from the mean. So this perturbation up here of 0.06 was almost 1 standard deviation above the mean and so on. And then over here, this gives you the percentage changes in everything. So the mu went down by 7%. The sigma didn't change by much. and the Sharpe ratio went down by something approaching 7%. Now, this is a pattern that is really consistent with experience. Again, the Sharpe ratio is the ratio of the mean return over the risk at the tangency portfolio. And like the minimum variance portfolio, when estimated on data, the variability of the standard deviation of the tangency portfolio tends to be small, whereas the mean is large. So, you know, this change in the Sharpe ratio is almost all accounted for by the change in the mean return, okay? So this is giving you a kind of fundamental understanding to the influence function that mirrors very much the way things work in practice, okay? I just wanted to show you that if the property that says if you put the contaminating vector right at the risk-free rate, you get zero. And I unfortunately rounded to four digits here, but I'll do this absolute the next time, and you'll see that these numbers are like, you know, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 15 or something. They're really, really small. So you should always compute to make sure that you didn't make a mistake in your algebra. And then here's, I wrote another function. I'm just sort of getting up to the point of studying how these influence functions look, and they're very complicated. They're not very intuitive except for these special properties. But what I did was, this is a small segment of something where I'm going to have, three variables. Now, I did it for two here, where I want to be able to make contour plots or trellis plots or what have you by looking at a range of x's and x1's and x2. So here I let x2 be minus 5, x1 go minus 5, 0, 5. And that's done up here. N steps equal 3. I can vary that. And k equal 5 says I'm going to go 5 standard deviations up and 5 standard deviations down from the mean. And, you're seeing that same pattern over here that almost all the variability of the Sharpe ratio or changes in the Sharpe ratio are accounted for by the changes in mu and very little in the changes of sigma. And then I made some plots here. And the blue is terrible color, but you can almost see it. If you increase the K, the range you go, almost all the influence functions I looked at, which is only a few, they're unbounded. They come down and then they go up again, but they don't look like anything that you're, you know, used to talking to mom about, right? I mean, they're kind of, in this case, you can see that as you increase X2, for every X1 in this range, things are monotone decreasing, but then as you increase X1 from minus 5 to 0 to plus 5, the curves are moving up. But what you can see is when X1 is 0 and X2 is 0, you're at the 0 point, which is one of the properties. And then I just have a picture going the other way of condition on X2 and looking at it as a function of X1. So if you like, this is just the beginning. Trying to figure out what's going on here. So the open questions are, a full exploration of the influence surface is 2D and 3D, and I've got the machinery in place to do that now. One of the applications that seems potentially useful is to stress test portfolios of arbitrary dimension by taking these expressions with the influence function with a vector in there. They are not quadratic forms, so they have quadratic dependency, and try to take all contamination vectors of dimension 10, you have 10 stocks, of constant length in the covariance matrix metric, inverse covariance matrix metric, and search for the direction that perturbs the portfolio the most. So that's something like a diagnostic on portfolios that real portfolio managers could be interested in. And one of the things that really motivates you when you're working on these applications in finance, you know, they are not just another dissertation. They are not just another paper. If you're really lucky, somebody actually uses it and perturbs it and then doesn't tell you how they perturb it, you know. So now this is a big deal because all of this has been done, as in the classical Markowitz case, with short selling allowed. That's the only case in which you can get a clean analytic solution. Otherwise, you have to use numerical optimizers. This begs the question, if you put an inequality constraint on weights, all weights are non-negative, how do you compute influence functions? Well, you know that if you get a solution with inequality constraints and the constraints are not binding, then if you compute the influence function and the argument is such that the constraint would not have been binding, then you have a valid calculation. But this looks like a really challenging problem to me, and I don't know if it's really doable, though I started talking with Jim Burke in the math department at UW about it. One of the problems that's plagued people in finance, they look at the Sharpe ratio, and it's this horrible expression, and they don't know what the standard error of the Sharpe ratio is. Well, now, recent years, people have been using bootstraps and double bootstraps to do that, but we do have, you know, the variance expressions that you get from the influence functions that might be useful. Might be. And I don't know, this last one is this optimal bounded influence. You know, does that make any sense here? Is there an optimal bounded influence estimator? You know, minimize the variance of the Sharpe ratio subject to a bound on the influence of your covariance and mean vector. It looks very hard to me. Have I got like 5 minutes or 10 minutes? I think I started a little late.
7 minutes.
So, first of all, any questions on this? Because then I would like to move to tell you a little bit about CVAR. It's such a beautiful and meaningful result of Rockefeller's, and I think it opens up the door to many kinds of interesting applications. I'd like to move to that on transparency. Is there any questions or comments about this?
Can I comment on the last one?
Yeah.
I think there are two issues. One is what the finance people call the estimation risk.
Right, right.
What you're talking here is the model risk.
Right.
And I think there is a paper where there is a trade-off between these two. The estimation risk is when, you know, the fact that you have to estimate the covariance and the mean.
Right.
So you don't, then you plug it in. And in some situation, for some type of portfolio, the estimation risk is just dominating.
Yeah,
you don't have to worry about the model risk.
Right.
And vice versa.
Right.
So it's not so simple to say, well, let us bound the influence. And the second point,
could I make one quick reply there? I think the issue, though, is that the bulk of the estimation risk comes from estimating the mean vector with relatively small, not with outliers, you know, it's just that your precision of estimating the mean is a relatively large fraction of the actual sample means, and so things are wobbling around. So consequently, people back when started looking at, you know, Bayes-Stein estimators and got some improvements. I think that might be another route, is go back to Bayes-Stein again, right? So go ahead, sorry.
Well, it's related. The second point is about the prediction of unclean data.
Right, right.
Now, you say that, you know, if you know how to predict outliers, it would be nice, and but outliers might come up.
Sure,
in the future,
sure.
And probably will. And so if we use just the pure bounded influence estimate, you have probability bias because, we have two choices. One is to use the classical estimate, okay? And then it will be unbiased in the future,
Right.
The other possibility is to use a robust estimator. Then we will have problem, I mean, it will be not as variable, but it will be biased. And so I think we have to find, it's a mean square error trade-off.
Right. Right.
The last line is only part of the story.
Yeah, and in all fairness, there are asset classes for which, you know, you have heavy tailed distributions for which you have some hope, you know, of actually estimating some aspect of the tail structure. That's what, you know, a lot of the value at risk guys are doing today, you know, look, trying to estimate tail structure. In that case, you should try to make use of it if you think you have a reliable tail structure. Well, let me spend a few minutes on, thanks, LV. So let me spend just a few minutes, if I can show you. I just want to share with you something I think is, can we just turn the standby button there maybe? Can you push the standby button? I can turn my lap, pull the cable, pull the plug. Just point it over, just tilt it over to this, illuminate the clock. So one of the real troublesome aspects of the Markowitz theory is it's, you know, standard deviation as a measure of risk is not the most attractive thing. Furthermore, the poor behavior of the estimates with regard to bias actually comes from the fact that you have inverse sample covariance matrices floating around everywhere. And while you have an unbiased sample covariance matrix, when you take its inverse, the bias is embarrassingly large has a factor like P over N, where P is the number of instruments. And so when people have, you know, 50 instruments and 100 observations, that's a problem, and so on and so on. So, you know, what would be an alternative approach? This so-called conditional value at risk is actually something I mentioned to Victor, I think, 5 years ago, maybe. Well, suppose you have the distribution of your portfolio returns. This quantity right here, if this is a lower percentile, like a lower, you know, 1% or whatever, 5%, is called value at risk in the finance industry. And a lot of the focus on risk management for some time was, okay, fit a normal distribution, you know, find out what the lower percent point, 1% point is, and declare that your value at risk. You only lose more than that in a given period with probability 0.01. Well, that seems like a very, very poor way to measure downside risk, because a more natural thing might be to, well, one extreme would be, say, just take the smallest observation you've ever gotten, right? Well, if you take the smallest observation you've ever gotten, that seems to be overly conservative. And if you take this point here, that seems to be overly optimistic. So why not just take the conditional mean of your returns, given your returns are below a lower percent point? That's what any statistician would think of when they looked at this problem. So Rockefeller and Uryasev, in this paper is in Journal of Risk in 2000, introduced the term CVAR, conditional value at risk, to mean the expected value of returns given returns are below a lower percent point, and then try to optimize that. Now, keep in mind, when you optimize that, this lower percent point changes, as well as the conditional mean below the lower percent point. So you look at that, and it seems very, very natural. Why not do it? And, well, it looks very hard. I mean, at first glance, this looks like a very, very hard problem. Just turning around, putting a minus sign, and just I was trying to follow their paper, so they put a minus sign, so you're trying to minimize the conditional mean above this percent point. And you do it subject to a constraint of achieving at least, this should be a weak inequality greater or equal to mu zero. And someone, nice transparency, just says, well, this is what you want to do, and the way they did it was also subject to no short selling, because it's going to be a numerical solution in the end. The question is, this is highly desirable, very intuitive, but the solutions that exist, and are they easily computable? And I was totally amazed last year to hear Rockefeller's co-author come to University of Washington and present the results of their paper, which is that, in fact, the problem has a solution. It's a very, very beautiful solution. It turns out that I just want to put this up, not talk about it too much. Terry Rockefeller, who's an expert in convex and optimization, you know, everyone knows him probably. He's got a famous book on convex analysis. Looked at this problem for not more than 15 minutes and proposed this modified functional, which has the property that this functional is convex, and that if you minimize this functional, you minimize the CVAR. You minimize the conditional mean above that upper percent point, including the position of the upper percent point. And this is the kind of thing, reminds me of Peter Huber's original paper, right? So here was this min-max theorem in 1964 that did something that people would sort of do anyway. It was asymptotically equivalent to a trimmed mean, and it seemed very intuitive. This is the best of the intersection between mathematics and statistical practice. Here, this turned out to be convex functional. So, and convex functionals are nice. How do you actually, that expression depends on a known density, but of course you have to use data, but the natural thing to do is you sort of have an integral here, so you just replace it by a sample average. Okay? This is still convex, and it's convex in the weight vector and this t. And when you solve this, you get the answer. And furthermore, there's one little transparency missing. There's a common trick in which this is not a linear programming problem yet, but there's a common trick by introducing auxiliary variables in which you convert this to a linear programming problem with a bunch of additional auxiliary variables, and then you solve it with a good LP problem with CPLEX or with NuOpt or something. And there's a whole industry going on with this. That is that Uryasev has been consulting with Algorithmics and some well-known risk management companies. And there's all sorts of other, quantities that you can apply this to besides just the the return. You can apply it to drawdown and other things that occur in finance. So it leaves open. There's one other thing in their paper. I'll just tell you. There's a proposition that says if your portfolio returns are normally distributed, then CVAR gives the same solution as Markowitz, and it's a very easy proof. Okay, in the population, I mean, if you actually have the density, but I say so what, right? I mean, that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is in non-Gaussian situations. However, there are a bunch of simple questions you can ask here, like in the finite sample situation, when you take this approach, you don't have to estimate a sample covariance matrix. The mean vector is still sitting there is a problem. But you know, so the question is, what is the small sample variability of this estimator, and is it any better than Markowitz in the case that things are normally distributed? We're starting some various projects along these lines. One thing, though, is clear is that for each lower percent point you pick, you get a different risk measure and you get a different sort of frontier. Right, and they're sort of, you know, under Gaussianity, you can map them all back into the Markowitz frontier. But the question of the variability of the solution here actually is intuitively going to depend very heavily on what percentage point you take, right? So if you decide you're going to use a 0.01 percent point, you just got a few observations down there. They're highly variable. They don't get averaged much, right? And so your solution intuitively is going to be quite variable. But if you use a 10% point or a 20% point, now you're averaging more data. So all I want to do is tell you about this. I think it's a very, very exciting result. You wouldn't come across it, you know, in statistics normally. And there is an open question, how do outliers, you know, affect this approach, and what do we do about it? So that's exciting, I think. Thank you.
Well, Doug, I'm always intrigued by the fact that people in finance, they react two ways. One is you can cut, you're doing quantile, and you could, but a lot of people are interested, well, how poorly did I do, say, relative to the risk-free rate? What's, you know, my losses relative to the risk-free rate?
Right.
It's that tail, right? But that's cutting it from the x-axis up, if you will, rather than looking at the quantile down. And that's the lower partial moment, which Markowitz worked on a lot, too. And and VAR came out of this, what is this, Basel study or something?
Yeah, right, right, right.
So people look at quantile.
Those were the CEOs who had one stat course, if any, and decided if everything was normal, and they knew how to estimate the mean and standard deviation.
Yeah, the natural thing is some kind of lower partial moment, not a quantile, at least.
Well, these are sort of lower partial moments, right? If you let beta equal 0.5, you know, you've got the lower mean, right?
Well, but it's one thing to cut it and say, I want to be below some cutoff point. I want to look at that lower tail, rather than coming in and looking at the 2% point and going down and finding the quantile. So those are two different things. And unfortunately, the lower partial moments lose a lot of these 90s.
Yeah, I don't, yeah.
They are not as tractable as this.
Yeah.
So this is caught up. So
I've never been fond of lower partial moments in general. I mean, there's a lot of literature on it, but, you know, it's sort of, I don't know. But, I mean, obviously you can express your constraint on returns in terms of excess returns here. That's no problem.
Oh, no, that's
no problem. But, by the way, there isn't, you know, when Uri Asev was in Seattle a couple weeks ago, and I said, well, gee, you know, if the maximum value is too conservative and the VAR is too optimistic and you're using a conditional mean, it's still true that, you know, one gross outlier could come into the risk side. And so I said, well, you know, so you could think about doing slight robustifications of the risk measure. Now, some people might say, oh, you know, God, no, you know, that one point was, you know, that should be left in there. But, you know, who knows?
The value of risk came out of, it's perfectly all right to have your investment bank fail one time to 100 times.
According to VAR, right?
According to VAR.
Yeah, right.
That people take risks, and J.P. Morgan will fail every once in a while. They will not have enough assets to back up their...
Right,
their
right.
Risk.
So then you should be totally conservative, maybe. Who knows? Anyway.
Okay. I propose that we continue discussing the rate. So let us thank again...